History made in Philadelphia, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hillary Clinton is now officially her party's nominee for president, and she's got supporters across the globe.
Given that the United States is such a big power, to have a woman as the president of the United States sends a very special message to the rest of the world.
Also, our intrepid reporter tried Philly's famous cheesesteak, and
there was a lot of this sort of processed cheese. What you just named it, cheese Swiss.
Yeah, he was disappointed. Plus, two young women from the Bronx head for the Dominican Republic, where Zika is a big concern.
We're both going to the DR, so I'm kind of worried, I'm not going to lie. Like, let's say I get it, how long am I going to have a fever, rash?
Those stories, today on The World. Glad you could make it here on this Friday. We've got a lot to get to on the show today, but we want to start with Hillary Clinton's big moment on the stage last night at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. For the first time ever, a woman accepted a major party's nomination for president. And now begins a 14-week battle to win over voters. The world's Maria Muriel just returned to Boston from the Democratic National Convention. She told me where she was last night at that historic moment.
I was actually at the airport on my way back to Boston, but even at the gate waiting for the plane, there were TV screens showing the speech. And as Chelsea Clinton was introducing her mother, Hillary Clinton, women and their daughters were, instead of rushing to board the plane, as people usually do, they were sitting down and transfixed by what was going on in the screen. And I saw some of them tearing up, actually. Mm-hmm. And then on the plane, I looked around and there were so many people, most of them women, who were watching the speech on the plane, also on the TV screens in the little seats. It was a really powerful moment, definitely.
Well, you were reporting on American identity at both conventions, asking people what it meant to be an American. What were the differences you found between Cleveland and Philadelphia?
One of the most striking things from both of the conventions were that at the RNC in Cleveland, there were lots of American flags in the crowd. People were wearing American flag hats, shirts, and everything. And at the DNC, I didn't see that many American flags until Hillary Clinton took the stage, actually. But before that, I did see people wearing flags from the country that they were from.
Interesting.
So let's say you have like a Trinidadian American, they had a Trini flag, and a Jamaican Americans I saw with Jamaican flags and people from Puerto Rico with Puerto Rican flags. And what that said to me was that at the RNC, the idea of diversity was you come in and you blend into this idea of what America already is. And at the DNC, diversity is you bringing your heritage and displaying it out loud in that way. Like the flags were a very telling sign to me.
Yeah, I mean, flags are powerful images. And that kind of feels like it reflects the identity of the crowd. Did the speakers at the podium reflect that as well?
So at the DNC, the crowd was a lot more diverse, irrefutably so, whereas at the RNC, the crowd was visibly much whiter. But, you know, on stage, they did have speakers from different backgrounds at both conventions. It was just more mirrored in Philadelphia than in Cleveland.
As to that question, what does it mean to be an American? What kind of answers did you get? What was the most interesting one?
My most interesting answers came from protesters at a rally for Puerto Rico that happened in Philadelphia earlier this week. And most of the answers that I had been getting up until that point were, you know, America means freedom. America means being able to do whatever you want. But for a lot of these Puerto Rican activists, they were just so blunt about the fact that America meant almost a hypocrisy to them because they feel that the United States doesn't get a claim on this word. You know, I grew up in South America, and that is a sentiment that I remember. You know, it's not just the United States of America. American means the entire continent of the Americas.
So we're going to hear in just a minute from women around the world getting their perspective on the U.S. getting its first presidential nominee who is a woman. But your personal take on that, Maria, what does it mean to you?
Like I said, I grew up in South America, and one of the things I was thinking about last night was it is a big moment for the United States. But then I thought about all these South American countries who have had female leaders, like there's Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Costa Rica, and I can say, you know, having grown up there, that South American culture is a lot more patriarchal, I think, than U.S. culture. But we still haven't had a female leader, and for Hillary Clinton to get this nomination is still a very historic moment. So I think that was a little striking to me.
Thanks for catching up to South America, North America.
Right.
The world's Maria Muriel, just back from covering the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
No matter your politics, when Hillary Clinton accepted the nomination last night, it was a powerful image for women, not just here, but around the world. We're going to hear now from five women outside the U.S. on their thoughts about Clinton's historic nomination.
I'm Kim Clutie. I'm a journalist from Cape Town, South Africa. It was exhilarating watching Hillary Clinton accept the Democratic Party nomination for president. I was extremely proud to see a woman scoop the nomination for the first time. And really, I think it's a victory for equality. And I think what really came through was Hillary's resilience and her determination. So she's an example to so many people, I think, in the US and countries like South Africa, to never give up. I think it's extremely historic because if Hillary wins the election, then three of the most powerful nations in the world, the US, Germany, and the UK, will be run by women. And that's pretty significant and a sweeping change. And it's also very significant for developing countries like South Africa, because the more women rise and take the reins of power, the stronger the case for women in developing countries. So many of us in South Africa have been watching the US election campaign very closely, and we're hoping that it'll be a turning point for women in politics if Hillary becomes president, and that hopefully could have a ripple effect across the world.
My name is Urvashi Sani. I live and work in India. I'm an educator with a focus on girls' education. I was really exhilarated. I think that in terms of women's rights, it's really very special because given that the United States is such a big power, to have a woman as the president of the United States sends a very special message to the rest of the world. I know that you have a German chancellor as a woman and now a British prime minister as a woman, but even then, the United States has never had one, and this is very special, and I think women all over the world are cheering for this. All the women I've spoken to in India are absolutely thrilled that she made it to the nomination, and we hope that she'll make it to the presidency as well.
My name is Lorena Rios. I'm a freelance journalist based in Istanbul, Turkey. I think it's an extraordinary moment to witness a female presidential candidate on stage for America itself and what it represents worldwide. So it was very moving. It is very encouraging as a woman to witness Hillary address the country with so much poise and know-how. Being a woman, it's just very aspiring. My only concern is that Americans should be aware of keeping their politicians on check, regardless of the political party, because I'm from Mexico and I understand the U.S. importance on the global stage. So having a strong leader is important for Americans at home, but also internationally.
I'm Nadine Gassman, UN Women Representative in Brazil. I think Hillary's story shows the struggle that she, as so many women, have to get where she is. And I think, you know, it's never easy for women to get to power positions. She has had to go through a lot, but it is groundbreaking and a ceiling breaking, as she herself said, having her as a candidate for the presidency of the United States. I think it gives a very good example to women around the world. And I think it's also an example for women and political women throughout the world to see that it's happening, we're changing, we're working. It is really very inspiring. It's a way to show her strength, her energy, her intelligence, and the fact that it can be done.
This is Agnieszka Dolemba, a PhD candidate from Warsaw, Poland. I live in Poland, which for over 2 years is being under a leadership of two women, Ewa Kopacz and Beata Szydło. I also live in Europe, whose leadership is strongly influenced by Angela Merkel, and it is also a Europe where tough experience of Brexit will be coordinated by another woman, Theresa May. So a woman being nominated for a president of the United States does not come as a shock to me. There was only one moment when I thought about gender in this campaign, and it was when Secretary of State Clinton announced her vice president to be Senator Tim Kaine and not Senator Elizabeth Warren. I then told myself that I wished to live in a world where the thought of two women leading one of the most powerful countries in the world will be as normal as the thought of one woman leading it.
We heard there from women in Poland, Brazil, Turkey, India, and South Africa. Hillary Clinton has already broken many glass ceilings to get to where she is, but there's one more that she still has to overcome before entering the White House, the fact that no former Secretary of State has been elected president since before the Civil War. Several have tried, but none have been successful. The last to even attempt it was Al Haig. So if there is a history question on the show, who are you going to call? How about the world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf? I asked him why it's so hard to make that journey from Foggy Bottom to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, I think it would be lovely if we could take the simplistic answer and imagine that somehow there's a curse or a jinx that was created by James Buchanan, who was the last former Secretary of State to become president in 1857. And he's universally reviled, as most people may remember, as perhaps the worst president that the United States has ever had. But in reality, it's got much more to do with the changing nature of the two jobs and the nature of politics itself. And there's a great summary of all this in an article that appeared in the Smithsonian Magazine a couple of years ago.
And so how many former secretaries of state made it to the presidency in the early years of the Republic?
Well, six in all: Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Martin Van Buren, and then, of course, the cursed James Buchanan. So that's six of the first 15 presidents who served together about 32 years as president out of the 64 years between Washington and Lincoln.
What changed?
Well, in a word, politics. There was this kind of clubbish system of closed-door meetings for choosing president. I mean, there was the show of the Electoral College, but really just a few wealthy white men made the decisions. But in the words of presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, this began to change with the spread of suffrage. That kind of cosmopolitan sophistication that goes with the Secretary of State job no longer had mass appeal or didn't work because you needed mass appeal. So as Brinkley said, you've got to play big in Des Moines, not in Paris,
gotcha,
to become president. I mean, just think how John Kerry suffered after his French connections came out. And then again, after the Civil War, the other big change was that the job of Secretary of State itself began to change from being kind of a place where you could groom your successor and that develop this kind of sophistication and knowledge about the world. The nature of U.S. diplomacy started to get a lot more challenging, a lot more sophisticated, and the job became a lot more specialized. So the job of Secretary of State started going to talented administrators and then occasionally kind of as a political consolation prize to presidential contenders who had needed to be bought off.
So what do you think, Chris? Can Hillary Clinton reverse the curse of former secretaries of state occupying the White House?
Well, it would be a dramatic shift for sure. By the way, it's not just Secretary of State. Pretty much any cabinet post is cursed. There's only, in fact, been two presidents since the Civil War who've even served in a cabinet of a previous administration. That's Taft and Hoover. So not exactly the best examples either. But as Stephen Hess of the Brookings Institution told the Smithsonian Magazine, Hillary's already broken so many norms that by now she's kind of in a category by herself.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, who is in his own category. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
A quick look ahead to another convention-related story we'll have later on the show. Last night, Pakistani-American Hizr Khan spoke at the DNC. He honored his son, a Muslim-American army captain who died fighting in Iraq. And he took Donald Trump to task for saying he would ban Muslims from entering the U.S. if he were elected president. It was a message that went down well among Muslim Americans.
It was relieving, it was affirming, it was validating, and it was very symbolic.
More on that story coming up in a bit. You're with the world. Aleppo, Syria. It is one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. Back in 2004, 7 years before the Arab Spring, it was Syria's biggest city with over 2 million people. But Aleppo has been under siege for months. Much of the city is in ruins and many residents have fled. The Syrian army cut off Aleppo's last remaining supply route earlier this month. There are still more than 300,000 people in the city. The world's Richard Hall has been following the situation in Aleppo. He's based in Beirut. So I know you've been speaking with some people in Aleppo. What do they tell you about the situation on the ground, Rich?
The situation in eastern Aleppo now, where the siege is in place, is pretty terrible. The siege began earlier this month when Syrian forces cut off the only remaining road out of eastern Aleppo. And since then, no food or medical supplies have been able to go in. Medical facilities have been overwhelmed as the bombings have continued. I spoke to an activist called Ismail Al-Abdullah. He's a 28-year-old. He lives in the eastern part of the city. And he told me in the past couple of days, the markets were completely empty.
All the people who are in the street ask one question. They want a bread. They want some bread.
And Rich, Aleppo is very much in ruins. That was on Skype. How have you been speaking with people there?
There are still people there that can conjure up an internet connection. And at times when they're able to find a place quiet enough to talk, we can talk to them via WhatsApp and Skype.
How did Aleppo get to this point?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is the culmination of two things, really. It's the result of the US reducing support for the Syrian rebels fighting Assad, and conversely, Russia stepping up its support for Assad. Hmm. Now, the US hoped the rebels could force Assad to negotiate, but Russia's entry into the war changed all that, and it's tipped the scales in Assad's favor. He's now winning the war. He's surrounding Aleppo, and he looks much less likely to negotiate now.
This week in Geneva, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Sergei Lavrov, his Russian counterpart, to discuss, among other things, the situation in Aleppo and Russia's involvement in the siege. What came out of those meetings?
So the basis of these meetings were to negotiate coordination between U.S. and Russia to go after Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda-linked rebel group, which both agree should be bombed. The U.S. hoped that they could get Russia to lay off the more moderate rebel groups in return for cooperation against Nusra. And there was a kind of a tacit agreement that this would happen, that Russia would lay off the moderate groups. But what we've seen in the past few days has been completely the opposite. Russia and Syria have looked to press their advantage in Aleppo. They're demanding that the rebels surrender, and they're demanding that the civilians leave the city, or they can't guarantee their safety.
Wow. So while Kerry and Lavrov are meeting in Geneva, what do you reckon Abdullah, the activist we heard from earlier, what's he thinking back in Aleppo?
He told me that there's a sense that people have been abandoned by the U.S. and the international community. The U.S., at the beginning of this conflict, supported the rebels against Bashar al-Assad. And as the conflict has gone on, they've kind of backed away from that support. And this is what he told me.
America doesn't say anything about the killing. More than 500,000 people were killed by Assad forces and Russian forces. They reached an agreement.
Well, you can really hear the anger and disappointment about being abandoned there. Would Abdullah actually leave Aleppo himself?
Well, he's like many other people in the city. I mean, they've stayed there throughout this horrible conflict. Aleppo has seen barrel bombs. It's seen daily rocket strikes. And these people are living in absolute hell, and yet they still want to stay there. There's a sense that their way of fighting back is by staying in their homes. And so many people, even after all this, are continuing to say they'll stay in the city.
The World's Richard Hall in Beirut. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Across the border in Turkey, the government crackdown continues. Turkey's interior minister said today that 18,000 people have been detained since the failed coup plot exactly 2 weeks ago. A number of them are members of the press, and today 21 journalists appeared in court. There are a handful of the estimated 90 in the Turkish media who've been ordered arrested. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is known to be thin-skinned, and the lively satirical press in Turkey, Erdogan has not spared them. Jonathan Geyer is a fellow with the Institute of Current World Affairs. He just returned to his base in Cairo from a month of researching comics and culture in Istanbul. So you follow political satire all over the Middle East. How do you think Turkish satire fits in to the rest of the satire in the region?
Well, Turkey has one of the most advanced comic scenes in the world, probably just after Japan and the U.S. Political satire in Turkey is maybe the most radical outlet for criticism of the government. There are about a half dozen or more weekly comic magazines, plus political cartoons are just huge in the daily newspapers, online, Facebook, Twitter. This is one of the funniest societies when it comes to political cartoons and comics.
Yeah, and was cartoonist reaction equally lively right after the attempted coup?
Oh, I've just seen some of the most audacious cartoons of President Erdogan and about the military.
Like what? What'd you see?
Grotesque drawings of President Erdogan looking kind of bug-eyed and silly, addressing supporters. A group of supporters chanting that they want executions reinstated in the country, and Erdogan saying, that's a democratic demand I can get behind.
Wow.
So literally from the day after the coup, cartoonists in Turkey have been hitting quite hard against their president.
And considering that President Erdogan has gone after the media there, what's happened to the cartoonists?
Well, every cartoonist I interviewed in Turkey told me that 2016, irrespective of the recent coup and crackdown, has been the most difficult year for cartoonists on record. About 1,500 people, including cartoonists, celebrities, journalists, are under investigation for insulting the president. And among them are some of the most prominent cartoonists and comic magazines in the country. One satirist and columnist, Ahmed Alkan, is among these 90 who had warrants out for their arrest. But so far, none of the cartoonists I've spoken to are under legal threat at the moment. Last week, following the special coup edition of the comic weekly Le Monde, a band of thugs tried to break into the comic magazine. Luckily, police turned them away, but these comic artists definitely feel under threat today in Turkey.
So that one magazine put out a special coup edition?
Indeed. It was a really funny cover. It was actually banned quite quickly. Police went door to door to shops, confiscating it because it suggested a kind of bigger scheme or conspiracy behind the July 15th coup.
But presumably cartoonists in Turkey are freer to draw what they want than cartoonists in other parts of the Mideast, I would guess.
Yes and no, Marco. Mm. The legal assault on cartoonists in Turkey has really been unprecedented over the past few years under Erdogan. And one cartoonist, Musa Kart, who has been sued for drawing Erdogan as a kitten and for drawing Erdogan as a bank robber, he told me that there's no serious journalist or cartoonist who doesn't have a case against him or her right now in the country.
Wow. So post-attempted coup, is the crackdown on Turkish satirists effectively shutting them down?
One might think so, but in fact, the level of satire I've seen about the situation is just gunning and going strong on social media, in Turkish newspapers. All of the cartoonists are maintaining their radical bent and really being ombudsman and holding the government to account. So we'll see how it goes in the next period. But for right now, being a cartoonist in Turkey is incredibly difficult, but this is a fearless band of illustrators.
Are you concerned that they're so fearless that that might get them in trouble eventually?
When I spoke with illustrators earlier this month, prior to the coup, I asked them about the 1980 coup and about the circumstances then. And one cartoonist I met was on the lam for a decade, running from authorities. Other publications were shut down. They have experience with this kind of clampdown. So as frightening as it might seem for us as observers in America or Europe, in Turkey, this is kind of what comes with the job for illustrators and satirists.
Jonathan Geyer has just returned to his base in Cairo after a month of researching comics and culture in Istanbul. Thank you, Jonathan. Always great to speak with you.
Thanks, Marco. A pleasure.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. One of the most powerful moments of the Democratic Convention came before Hillary Clinton's speech, when the father of a fallen U.S. soldier addressed the crowd.
He was telling America that a man can be both American, a Muslim, and a Pakistani immigrant without any discord or disloyalty or divisions.
That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We want to pick up on one more moment from the DNC last night, when Khizr Khan and his wife Ghazala stood at the podium. They're originally from Pakistan. Their son Humayun Khan was born in the United Arab Emirates. Eventually, the family moved to the United States and became American citizens. Humayun Khan joined the U.S. Army. He died while serving in Iraq. Today, he is one of many troops buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Last night, Khizr Khan used his time on stage to honor his son's service and to take exception to Donald Trump's recent comments about banning Muslims from entering the U.S.
You're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution?
Khan then reached in his pocket, took out his personal copy of the Constitution, and offered to share it with Trump. It was an emotional speech for many people, including writer and attorney Wajahat Ali.
Let's just reflect on this. The nation, the world, saw a Muslim immigrant from Pakistan stand in front of thousands of people in the Democratic National Convention and remind America about its core values and freedoms, taking out a worn-out copy from his jacket pocket of the Constitution and waving in front of everyone. And I talked to the daughter-in-law of Khizr Khan, Fatima, and she said that as long as she's known her father-in-law, he's had that same copy, and he busts it out at any moment to show people why he's in this country. And I think that's very powerful and profound, that it was a Muslim immigrant from Pakistan who was the one who perhaps, you know, really brought it home about what's really at stake
if Trump wins the presidency.
So that was kind of the overall arc of his comments last night. Specifically, what did you really kind of relate to? What resonated for you?
I mean, three things resonated. First and foremost, the fact that you had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a Muslim American, come out and introduce the clip of Humayun Khan, another Muslim American who won the Purple Heart posthumously because he was killed in line of duty. And then you had Ghazala, we should mention Ghazala, the wife of Khizr Khan, come out on, you know, primetime television right before Chelsea. So it was very deliberate that Muslim Americans were front and center, brought out by the Democrats in a moment of division and racism and Islamophobia to essentially remind Americans of what's at stake with our freedoms and liberties and core values. And the fact that, you know, Khizr Khan, a Pakistani American uncle, look, I said, this is amazing that a Desi uncle, someone who I could drink chai with, is standing at the podium with his wife wearing the dupatta shawl, kind of getting the biggest rapturous applause and trending on social media for something not related to national security or terrorism, but something related to values and freedom and the Constitution. And I use dark humor because apparently, you know, that's the world we live in right now. We need some dark humor for all the absurd nonsense that we're subjected to. It's a bit cathartic, but it was relieving, it was affirming, it was validating, and it was very symbolic.
So Khizr Khan mentioned his undivided loyalty to the United States, and I noticed right after that some people on social media were kind of upset and wondered why he dismissed his dual identity. And then the pushback today in, like, this post, for example, where is the empathy for immigrant parents who struggled so much to give their son the best life possible, only for him to lose it in a needless war? What do you make of these comments and this back and forth?
I mean, this, you know, unfortunately, when you become a symbol and you stand up as a person of some marginalized communities, for him, it's Muslim Americans and also immigrant and also Pakistani Americans, you cannot placate everyone. You know, he had his 7 minutes. And what I tell people is, listen, give him the benefit of the doubt. These are grieving parents who stood in front of thousands of people and they told their story. Their story might not be your story, but it is very symbolic and universal of many immigrants who come here. And, you know, the knock on immigrants and especially Muslims is we have divided loyalties, right? Prove that you're a patriot. Prove that, you know, your faith is not going to be paramount to your loyalty to this country. And there's always, if you will, a judge, jury, and executioner that is always willing to indict and, if you will, convict us. And so, yes, people should, like, you know, relax a bit and say, listen, this is Khizr Khan. He's a patriot who also stood proudly as an immigrant and as a Muslim. And this is what America is about. You can be a multi-hyphenated person with a multi-syllable name with mocha caramel skin and be authentically as American as a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and a Hillary Clinton and a Donald Trump if he remembers the Constitution.
So Wajahat, as a watershed speech, what effect will it have on the lives of immigrants in the U.S. Going forward? Is it going to be liberating in some way?
I mean, one would hope that a magical 7-minute speech could automatically uplift all the immigrants and cure away all the xenophobia and all the problems and enact immigration reform and, you know, positive policy change. I do not drink the Kool-Aid. I unfortunately do not have delusions of grandeur because I have two young babies who humble me. But look, it's powerful. It's profound. Just like Barack Hussein Obama, it's symbolic, right? Regardless of what you think of him. The fact that Khizr Khan was embraced, applauded, the fact that there was a standing ovation, maybe it will humanize, uplift, and give some well-earned respect to those immigrants with the funny names and with the funny accents who've been working in this country for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, making us great again and again and again.
That's Muslim American writer and lawyer Wajahat Ali. Okay, the Democratic and Republican conventions are finally in the rear view. But looking ahead, it's a 14-week long road to November. We're going to turn to our team that covered the conventions for us. The World's Leo Hornack and Maria Muriel, camped out in Cleveland and Philadelphia. You've been on the convention beat for 2 weeks. Do you guys feel like talking politics?
Not really.
Nope. Okay. Done.
Okay. So we're going to take a little side road here and talk about food instead, because there's a lot of it out there. And if it's not catered, it's not politics, right? So, Leo, Maria said last week she wanted you to eat a real Philly cheesesteak. How'd that go down?
Can I leave that as my answer?
All right, but you need to elaborate a little bit. I mean, what was it about the Philly cheesesteak?
Because
it's bread,
Marco,
it's steak. I mean, nothing wrong there. Okay. Was the cheese whiz the deal breaker?
Look, I know that Philadelphia is a very proud city, and we were recommended. Our guidebook had a Philly cheesesteak place that's the sort of traditional one. I'm not going to say the name of the place. I was really excited. I was really stoked about this. And we went there, and, well, look, there was a lot of this sort of processed cheese, kind of what is called cheese. What you just named it? Cheese
Swiss? Yeah.
Yeah. Listen.
Just say it,
I think it wasn't great. I'll just say that. I've got a theory, because maybe 20 years ago, this place was amazing. It got in all the guidebooks, and then they just relaxed and they let the tourists come each week. There's not going to be no return traffic. And someone's taken their eye off the ball. Someone's taken their hands off the steering wheel at these places. So I have a theory, and it was proved last night when I went round the corner in South Philly and I went just to the end of the block to a little bar, and I'm going to shout it out now, Madeira Bar. And I had an amazing Philly cheesesteak sandwich, and it was delicious. It was everything that this famous place, which I will not mention the name of, wasn't. I think that must be the real Philly cheesesteak sandwich.
Well, at least you had one good version of it. You are from, after all, the land of bubble and squeak, so I don't know what that's all about. Maria, you worked some long hours at the convention, staying up late, watching a lot of speeches. It can be tiring. So where'd you find time to find decent food?
It was hard, especially in Philadelphia, because the convention was sort of far away from everything else, and we didn't know to get food beforehand the first time we went. We didn't know to get food beforehand, and then
rookie
a couple
reporters.
Of... So we ended up eating a lot of, hot dogs and soft pretzels, and it was really hard to find original food.
So what was, between Cleveland and Philadelphia, what was your perfect food moment?
I have two.
Okay.
We stayed in Little Italy for the convention in Cleveland, and I managed to get out to a great Italian restaurant where we thought the opera was playing through the loudspeaker, but it was actually one of the staffers who was singing it.
Fantastic.
It was great. And then they came out and they brought some, vodka sauce pasta to, taste, in addition to the dish that we had ordered. So I felt great that night.
I had no idea Cleveland had a Little Italy.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know Little
it's
Italy.
It's great.
So my other favorite food moment was taking Leo to eat tacos in downtown Cleveland. And it wasn't like a traditional Mexican taco place, but I was telling Leo, tacos are a very American thing. Leo, you got to eat some tacos. And they serve this very hipster, fancy taco that was spilling out with its fillings. And so I turn over and Leo's eating the taco filling with a fork. And I say, no, Leo, no, you got to eat it with your hands.
That was your Bill de Blasio moment, Leo. Embrace it. So, Leo, I heard you had actually a very good food experience in Philadelphia.
We went to an Indonesian restaurant, which was it's called Hardina. I think it also deserves a little mention on the air. We went there. It's a little mom and pop stall. We were served by the 6-year-old daughter of the owner.
She may have been five.
She may have been five. And it was this incredible mix of soul food, because of the neighborhood it was in, blended with Indonesian food. This place was a proper South Philly experience. I'm not an expert in either of those cuisines. So please, listeners, if you know about them, block your ears. But it was collard greens with an amazing spicy beef kind of curry. Absolutely delicious, with lots of peanuts.
No, I had the beef curry. You had the spicy chicken. But
that's right.
I mean, great.
I like the way you kind of argue with each other like this old married couple. It's kind of cool. You should just keep that.
And it was the great kind of food that feels home cooked. It reminded me of one of my favorite places in Miami where I'm from. It's the Cuban cafeteria on Sunset and Galloway. Everybody might know what I'm talking about. I don't even know its name. They just serve the best baca frita. I love it. It's so great.
All right. Well, I love Indonesian food and I love soul food, so I'm going to have to go check it out myself.
I wish I could have taken most of the food home with me. Hardina in South Philly. Check it out.
The world's Maria Muriel and Leo Hornack, thank you both very much for telling us about your food experiences, and thank you very much for your reporting, too. It was great.
Thanks, Marco.
Absolute pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
So, Leo, Maria, tired of talking politics, but if you think you can handle a little bit more, we've got an interesting story for you on our website. It's about all the unofficial merch at the conventions. The buttons, the signs, the T-shirts, not officially sanctioned by either party. The Tale of Two Conventions of Schwag. That's up at PRI.org. Some news on the Zika virus now. We've got word today of the first case of local transmission of Zika in the continental U.S. In Florida, most likely from a mosquito. Still, most of the cases involve travel to places outside the U.S., places like the Dominican Republic. New York City has seen more than 300 cases of Zika. Nearly two-thirds of these cases have shown up in people who traveled to the DR. And as more Dominican New Yorkers make trips home this summer, the city's health clinics are ramping up their Zika education efforts. Audrey Quinn begins our story at the Bronx Health Center.
And there I found Karina Diaz and Giselle Hernandez. They're two 24-year-old cousins who like to joke that they're twins. I fell for it. They're both petite, same boyish style of clothes, same tightly cropped curly hair.
We're both going to the DR, Giselle and I. So I'm kind of worried, I'm not going to lie.
One of Karina's aunts in the DR got Zika, same with one of Giselle's old friends. But Karina says she makes the trip back home every summer. She moved from the Dominican Republic to the Bronx when she was 7. Giselle came just a year and a half ago. She's the shyer one. She says she still has a lot of people she cares about back there.
Almost all of them, yes, like families, friends.
Most of my family's over there. They're just now starting to get here.
Today they're both meeting with Dr. Tyler Evans to find out more about Zika. Giselle goes first.
In terms of the symptoms, what have you heard that it can cause?
Well, I heard about the redness in the skin and the fevers. Also, the pain in the inside.
He walks her through the preventative measures. Use bug spray with DEET. Sleep under bed nets coated with DEET. Stay inside around sunset. And watch out for those key Zika symptoms.
I'm going to give you a phone number that you can call either here or go to a local hospital in the DR, okay? Do you have any questions?
I should get that number for my friends, too.
Okay.
Yes.
Lisa Sutherland's the regional director for the Bronx Health Center. She says a lot of their patients are like Giselle and Karina. They're heading to Zika-affected countries this summer to see family. It's not just some optional vacation.
So basically, this is sort of a general flyer that we have up in all of our waiting areas. It kind of talks about sort of before you travel, kind of what you need to be looking at when you're traveling.
She wants people to know you don't have to be pregnant to be affected by Zika. This point comes up during Karina Diaz's visit with Dr. Evans.
Okay, so what do you know about Zika?
It's dangerous.
Okay. Right.
But I feel like there's more of a risk for pregnant women.
So not exactly. So
okay. So you're not
at an increased risk if you're pregnant, but the consequences are worse if you are pregnant.
Karina assures Dr. Evans she is not. But he still advises precaution. He goes through the same checklist he did with her cousin.
So let's say you get it now. Would you be concerned about, like, a pregnancy in the future?
No.
No. That's good. Why not?
I mean, I'm definitely a lesbian. Not going to get pregnant anytime soon, as far as I know.
Okay. Okay. Cool. So anything else that you're interested in knowing?
Are there, like, what are the long-term effects? Like, let's say I get it while I'm in the DR. How long am I going to have a fever, rash?
The symptoms will resolve within 21 days.
Wow, that's a really long time.
Most often it's less than 5 days.
Karina told me she'll be taking Zika more seriously now. She doesn't want to have to risk taking that much time off of work. Dr. Evans had one more piece of advice for her trip. Don't sleep outdoors. She looked at him like he was crazy. Never, she told him, not even in New York. For the World, Audrey Quinn, The Bronx.
Coming up, the Rio Olympics are only a week away. So what songs will be in your ears over the 3 weeks of the Games? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. That's the sound of 70,000 fans at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome. Roma, Roma, Roma. They're cheering one of the world's most famous soccer teams, AC Roma. Roma's got fans everywhere, including here in Boston. And the team happened to be training in our fair city in the past week. Our intern Daniel Hoffman just had to check it out. How'd you find out that Roma was right here in our backyard, Daniel?
I was just driving by, and I see a bunch of Roma signs next to a field. I pulled over, and I just saw Daniele De Rossi walking around. I had no idea he was here, and I was very surprised and excited to watch him play.
Oh, that's crazy, because I think I biked right by that field yesterday. I saw something going on. I had no idea. Now I know. So what was it like being there and watching this legendary team train?
It was amazing to watch all these famous players. It was also awesome to see fans from all over the world, different nationalities. I heard people speaking Russian, Hebrew, Spanish, Portuguese, Bosnian. And there was one player that everyone wanted to see.
I hear she Tati.
Definitely Tati.
That's an easy one.
It's Katati.
Francesco Totti.
Totti is a Roman legend, an Italian legend. I think football, it's one of the best strikers in the history of the game.
I'm taking classes in Harvard, and I was wearing a Totti jersey, and a Turkish friend told me, yo, you know that's actually AS Roma. He's in Harvard too. I'm like, no way. He told me because I was wearing the Totti jersey. So I had to come because I want to get a picture with my idol, Francesco Totti.
Okay, fairly unanimous. Francesco Totti was the big draw. Why was AC Roma even practicing in Boston in the first place?
Their owner's from Boston. They didn't actually play, but they had some events and they had some of the investors come watch the team. And it was an opportunity for regular fans to go watch them as well.
Yeah, so how was the turnout?
There are about 200 people, which sounds like a lot, but for the players, it probably felt like a vacation. If they were in Italy or in any other place where soccer was the number one sport, there would be thousands of people watching them.
If this was in Latin America in general, not only in Venezuela, this would be crazy. I mean, there'll be a lot more people.
What surprises me the most is that if you were in Italy watching an open-door training, such as this one right now, you would have had people singing, you know, ultras. Il capitano, c'è solo un capitano, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, well, this is Boston, so I guess the lesson here is when in Boston, do as the Romans do in Boston. Anyway, you can check out some photos of the Roma players and fans at PRI.org. Daniel Hoffman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
I don't know what you do for a living, but do you know what a music supervisor is? That's the person who selects the recorded music for movies and commercials. And I'm guessing the Rio Olympic Committee has sent more than one of them out on a scavenger hunt. With the games only a week away, they'll be seeking out the best, most hip Brazilian music, you know, to cover the sweeping shots of Copacabana and Ipanema. Yeah, pretty safe bet you're going to hear this a lot in the next few weeks. The girl from Ipanema, La Garota de Ipanema, sung here by Astrid Gilberto. And since the Olympics are about excitement, you'll probably be inundated with this classic from Sergio Mendes. I'm taking off on a little R&R for the next few weeks. I'll probably catch some of the Olympics on TV. But before leaving, I wanted to give you a crash course in some of the other Brazilian music, the music you should hear during the Olympics. So if you're a music supervisor still looking for great Brazilian music, get ready to take notes. The trick with Brazilian music is to cop the vibe of the country, but skip the cliches. I could easily hear this accompanying one of those warm, fuzzy stories about some athlete training hard for a shot at gold. It's called berimbau, about the distinctive Brazilian instrument, the berimbau. But it's the groove here that makes the tune. There's actually no berimbau in the arrangement. Capoeira me mandou dizer que já chegou, chegou para lutar. Berimbau me confirmou, vai ter briga de amor, tristeza camarada. Berimbau, a total classic in Brazil, this version by the group Golden Boys, and a tip of the hat to the BBC's Giles Peterson for shedding light on that recording. Here's another classic I hope you hear during Olympics coverage. Bananeira não sei, bananeira sei lá, a bananeira sei não, a maneira de ver. Bananeira não sei, bananeira sei lá, a bananeira sei não, isso é lá com você. That singer Emilio Santiago with a tune called Bananera, a totally tropical tune because it's about a banana tree with a seriously funky soul mucosa beat. All right, here's another one. This tune from singer Gal Costa with Caetano Veloso sharing vocals. Broadcasters could play this for athletes who shoot for the gold but end up with no medals. It's called Que Pena, or What a Shame. But the track's so happy, who cares if you medal or not? Ele já não gosta mais de mim, mas eu gosto dele mesmo assim. Que pena, que pena. Ela já não é mais a minha pequena. I love that tune by Gal Costa. There are so many other tracks I could play for you. Brazil has some of the best music in the world. You'll probably hear some of the frenetic beats of Baila Funk during the Olympics. You'll hear a lot of samba. And when we get that miracle moment when a world record is broken, some music supervisor better select this brilliant hip-hop sample of Mr. Big Stuff. Mr. Big Stuff sampled in Brazil becomes Senhor Tempo Bom, Mr. Goodbeat. I am out of here. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Our own Mr. Goodbeat is Eric Goldberg. He composed our theme song. I'm Marco Werman. Stay in touch with me on Twitter and Instagram at Marco Werman. I'm back with you in a few weeks.
Calça boca de sino, cabelo black da hora. Sapato era mocassim, eu salto plataforma. Gerson Quincombo mandava mensagens aos seus. Tony Bizarro dizia com razão, vai com Deus. Tim Maia falava que só queria chocolate. Tony Tornado respondia. Lady Zu avisava, a noite vai chegar. E com Totó inventou o samba soul. Jorge Ben entregava com coisa nostra. E ainda tinha o toque dos originais. Falador, passa mal, rapaz. Saudosa maloca, maloca querida, faz parte dos dias tristes e felizes da nossa vida. Grandes festas no Palmeiras como a Chique Show, Zimbabwe e Black Mad era um company soul. E nos 80 comecei a frequentar alguns bares, ouvia comentários de lugares. Clube da Cidade, Guilherme Jorge, Clube Holmes, Roller Superstar, Jabaquarinha, Sasquatch, como é bom lembrar. Agradeço a Deus por permitir que nos anos 70 eu pudesse assistir Vila Sésamo, numa década cheia de emoção.
PRI, Public Radio International.